another installment of Virtually Speaking Science, our monthly talk show on Blog Talk Radio and in Second Life, where we talk about cosmic topics ranging from climate change to the trends in science to trends in space and space missions like NASA's Mars mission that's coming up for launch this month, the MAVEN mission that's due to go into Martian orbit and study the atmosphere and try to unlock the secrets of Mars's ancient and current climate. So we have a great guest tonight, Dave Brain from the University of Colorado at LASP. He's a co-investigator for the MAVEN mission, and he's going to tell us all about it and what mysteries we hope to unravel as the result of the mission that is due for launch around November 18th. Right, Dave?
That's correct. Yeah, and thanks a lot for having me.
You bet. Tell me where the mission stands right now. The preparations must be accelerating.
Yeah, things are accelerating here towards the end. Our launch window opens November 18th. The spacecraft itself is down at the Cape in Florida, Cape Kennedy, and everything's looking good with the spacecraft, and the rocket is being made ready as well, the Atlas rocket that will give MAVEN a ride into space. And tonight, everything's scheduled to be rolled out to the VIF, the Vertical Integration Facility, where the spacecraft can be put on the rocket and made ready for launch.
Wow, great. So no hiccups have come up so far?
No, everything seems to be on schedule right now. And, of course, there's activity every day with the spacecraft, and any one thing could still happen that would cause us to take a step back and make sure that everything can make it into space safely. But as of right now, everything looks good. That's my understanding.
Actually, there was some controversy over the MAVEN mission during the time of the government shutdown. I remember that you almost had to have a special dispensation in order to continue work on the mission. So that must have been a little bit of a nail-biter for you.
That's correct. There were probably more butterflies at that time than there are even right now. And we actually did end up receiving a special dispensation. So MAVEN was shut down with the rest of the government for a little more than 2 days, somewhere between 48 and 72 hours, I think is correct. And at that time, we did receive an exception to continue launch preparations for MAVEN. Mm-hmm. And so some parts of the team were shut down that weren't critical to preparing the spacecraft to be ready for launch. But we were only down for a couple of days. And my understanding is that we were able to make up for lost time pretty well, even from being shut down.
Right. So the science is important for the MAVEN mission to look into how Mars's atmosphere has evolved and is continuing to evolve, but I understand that the government shutdown was about a different issue, and MAVEN has another critical role going forward. Could you talk a little bit about that before we dive into the science?
Sure, that's right. MAVEN does have another role that it's playing. It was selected as a science mission to go to Mars and study the upper atmosphere. And MAVEN's an orbiter that will orbit Mars. And there are a few other orbiters at Mars right now, one European spacecraft, Mars Express, and then also the NASA Mars Odyssey and Mars Reconnaissance orbiters. And these three orbiters that are at Mars now all carry relays that are able to take messages from the rovers on the Martian surface and relay them back to Earth. The rovers themselves are capable of communicating with Earth directly, but sometimes it's very efficient to pass data through orbiting spacecraft at Mars and the big antenna that those spacecraft have. So MAVEN is also carrying a relay, the next generation relay, and it'll be an asset at Mars that can be used to communicate with current rovers, such as the Curiosity rover, and any future rovers or landers that we may put onto the Martian surface.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it really is a vital communication link for the years ahead when perhaps some of those other orbiters aren't going to be as capable. MAVEN is expected to fill the gap.
That's right. The three orbiters that are there now are all doing very well, but they've all been there for a long time already. And so as things age, MAVEN will be ready to step up and fulfill the role of relay that some of these spacecraft are currently doing right now.
I guess that illustrates how the Mars exploration effort is actually a team effort, that you're not talking about just one probe working in isolation, that you have the Opportunity rover that's been there for almost 10 years now, and Curiosity rover that landed last year, and these orbiters that are providing support as well as the information that the rovers can follow up on. So where does MAVEN fit into that team?
Yeah, this is a great point that you make, because Mars is a system. It's an entire planet. And as scientists, we have specific questions about the planet, and we want to answer those questions. But the processes that we want to study all happen in the context of this larger planetary system. And so in many senses, the different spacecraft and orbiters and rovers and landers all have to work together to understand the entire planet, in much the same way that the team building even the MAVEN spacecraft has to work together, the engineers and the scientists and the administrators mm-hmm. and the designers. So the specific question that MAVEN is targeting relates to the climate of Mars and how it may have changed over time. And we have evidence that the Martian climate has changed over time. And there are three or four different lines of evidence, but one that's maybe most striking is that when we take pictures of the Martian surface, we look down and we see what appear to be dried up riverbeds on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty clear that water once flowed over the Martian surface, and it wasn't just a passing thing. It flowed for long periods of time, long enough to carve entire river channels that we can still see today. This can take hundreds or thousands of years of flowing liquid surface water.
Mm-hmm.
And the strange thing is that the atmosphere today doesn't support flowing liquid surface water for any reasonable length of time to carve river channels. It's maybe a few minutes or a few hours that liquid water could survive on the surface, not very long at all. And so right there, just from those pictures of riverbeds, we know that something changed on Mars over time. Something happened to make Mars transition from a place where water could flow over the surface to one where it couldn't flow today. And MAVEN is getting at one piece of that problem in terms of how the atmosphere evolved.
So that is one of the big mysteries that MAVEN is looking at, is what happened to the atmosphere. And people already have theories. We discussed this, and I addressed that in the little article that I put together for CosmicLog.com, where I'm the science editor for NBC News. So there are already some theories circulating about what happened to the atmosphere. Is it a settled question, or are there some controversies still to be ironed out?
No, I don't think it's a settled question at all. There are still many, many aspects of the situation to be worked out, many aspects of what happened to the Martian atmosphere to be worked out. I think that nearly all scientists would say that clearly something has changed on Mars over time, and the debate is more on what caused the change and how big the change may have been. And
mm-hmm.
to have liquid surface water on Mars, you need a much warmer atmosphere than you have today. You need an atmosphere that's above freezing, at least on average. And the average temperature on Mars today is 60 degrees, 65 degrees Fahrenheit below freezing, so too cold. And so one thing you need to do is make the atmosphere warm. And a great way of doing that is having a thicker atmosphere, more of a blanket around the surface that can trap in the infrared radiation or the heat that Mars is emitting. And to do that, you need a bigger, thicker atmosphere, maybe a one-bar atmosphere like Earth's, or maybe even larger than that. And so that's one big change that could have happened. So if the atmosphere used to be big and thick long ago, making it warm enough to support liquid surface water, then somehow you have to get rid of that atmosphere by today, because the atmosphere today is less than 1% the thickness of
mm-hmm.
Earth's atmosphere. And there are really only two places an atmosphere can go. There are really only two places you can put it. You can put it down into the surface and the subsurface, or you can move it up and strip it away to space, have it escape away to space. And scientists don't really understand the relative importance of these two processes. I think we all agree that both have happened over Martian history, that some atmosphere has gone down into the subsurface and some atmosphere has been stripped away to space. But the relative importance of the two processes and how the two processes have varied over time, I think, is really what's being debated now. And this is where MAVEN comes in. MAVEN is measuring and studying the processes, the up processes, the processes that take atmospheric particles and move them off of the planet by stripping them away.
How does the down part of the process go? We mentioned that there's really a team approach to exploring Mars, and so I imagine that another member of the team is looking into that issue of how elements of the Martian atmosphere somehow got captured perhaps within the rocks or the ice of Mars.
There are certainly members of the Mars science community that think about this. And so the MAVEN project is focused on the ups, and it's our goal to understand that part of the puzzle, to understand how much is being stripped away to space, how much has been stripped away over time. And this aspect of climate evolution on Mars is incredibly unconstrained right now. You could remove all of the oxygen in the Martian atmosphere in 100 million years, which is a blink of an eye in solar system history, or you could remove all of that atmosphere in 10 billion years. And so our goal is to understand this one part of the problem, and then this is where the community team aspect comes in. We take our puzzle piece, our answer that we formed with the MAVEN measurements, and we place it in context with the down processes, the people in the science community who study this aspect of climate evolution.
Mm-hmm. Are there other elements, angles to MAVEN's mission? How do you address that up versus down? It seems as if you would have to see what the current rate is and then you extrapolate to see what it was like in the past?
Yes, and there are a couple of different
ways. Kind of like a climate model for Mars.
Almost, but a climate, and like climate models, something that's based in observations. Plenty of models exist right now for how atmospheric particles get stripped away to space, but we want to take observations and use those to tune the models for this stripping process. And so the MAVEN observations will be used in a couple of different ways to look back in time. One, as you said, we'll measure the rate at which particles are being stripped away today. And this happens via several different processes. I'm lumping a bunch of different processes all under one umbrella of the ups. But we're going to measure each one of these different processes, and it's not enough just to measure them today and understand the rate today. What's more important and what's really novel about MAVEN is that we're going to understand how the loss rates from the atmosphere vary as the sun gets brighter or dimmer, or the solar wind, for example, which we haven't talked about, gets more or less intense. And so by understanding how the system responds as things outside of Mars change, that allows us to really start beginning to understand how to extrapolate back in time. So that's one approach. There's a second approach, however, if I can, which is sort of an independent way of looking at the importance of atmospheric escape. And that's the measurement of ratios of certain atmospheric gases at Mars today. For example, isotopes of argon or deuterium to hydrogen. And these isotopes, simply by measuring their relative abundance in the atmosphere today, give us a clue as to how much atmosphere has been stripped away over the entire history of the solar system. And so these two sort of independent assessments of how much atmosphere has been removed will be placed alongside each other in the MAVEN measurements to help us determine whether we have really answered the question.
So I wanted to mention that this talk that we're having is being broadcast on Blog Talk Radio, but it's also playing out in the Second Life virtual world. And it's pretty fun to get into Second Life and be with your friends, pals, like-minded people, and to interact. And so people are already interacting, and they're anticipating the discussion that we're going to have about the solar wind, the Martian dynamo, global magnetic field, and its absence on Mars. So they're almost getting a step ahead of us, which is pretty cool.
Wonderful.
These are pretty
yeah.
smart folks. And so you touched on the idea of the solar wind perhaps having a role in stripping away the molecules of the Martian atmosphere. And so I guess that's a mechanism that plays into the whole scenario of how Mars was in ancient times and why it's different today. I wonder if you could get into that a little bit more.
Oh, yeah, with pleasure, absolutely. The Martian magnetic field is actually the topic of my research in graduate school, the research that helped to get me my degree. And Mars, unlike Earth, does not have a global magnetic field. If you have a compass on Mars and you're walking around, you're lost. You have no idea which way north is. Earth has a big dynamo magnetic field generated in the interior. There's a lot of heat in Earth's interior. There's convection going on in the outer part of the core. Things are churning around, and all this electrically conducting material makes a big global magnetic field. Mm-hmm. Mars doesn't have this today. Mars is smaller than Earth, and we believe that the smaller size of Mars led to Mars not being able to sustain a big dynamo magnetic field today.
Mm-hmm.
What's really exciting, and I mean, that's really exciting, but what's even more exciting and more interesting is the fact that we have very strong evidence that Mars used to have a global magnetic field like Earth, and that this magnetic field shut off a little over 4 billion years ago, so that for almost all of Martian history, there has been no global magnetic field, and its atmosphere has been left exposed to the solar wind, these charged particles coming from the sun. Mm-hmm. On Earth, with a big global magnetic field, those charged particles coming from the sun are deflected around the planet. It's almost like a magnetic field is a big sneeze guard, a salad bar sneeze guard for
right.
the atmosphere.
Right.
And with Mars, you take away that sneeze guard, and the particles from the solar wind can go crashing right into the atmosphere. And they bring in so much energy that through various mechanisms, some of them physical through collisions and others electromagnetic, they can essentially grab particles from the atmosphere and splash them out and carry them away in the solar wind to space. And so the fact that Mars is missing a global magnetic field today, many scientists believe makes it more susceptible to atmospheric stripping processes and more susceptible to this big removal of atmosphere, this big climate change.
Mm-hmm. And so Albert Gainsburg is asking, it seems odd that Mars doesn't have that magnetic field. What happened to the liquid core flow? On Earth, you've got this liquid metal that is circulating, and it actually acts like a big magnet, and that's what generates Earth's magnetic field. But Mars seems to be less geologically active in that way. And so why did the flow slow down?
Well, to zeroth order, or the simplest answer to give, and there are always details associated with the answer, but
sure.
In its simplest form, Mars is just smaller than Earth. And so the analogy there is baked potatoes. A very large baked potato retains its interior heat much longer than a small baked potato. A small baked potato forms with less heat because it's smaller, and it radiates that heat away more quickly. And so you need a lot of heat inside to sustain a dynamo. And Mars simply couldn't sustain one for very long, maybe the first half billion years of its existence. Now, of course, there are all sorts of details that go into this and what can keep a magnetic field going. But the root cause is the size of the planet and its ability to maintain a temperature difference from the deep interior to the layers just above. It's that temperature difference that drives convection in the core, the same thing that makes a pot of boiling water boil in the first place. And when you have convection, then you can get a big dynamo magnetic field.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that there wasn't just one mechanism for having the atmosphere go up, up, and away. Are there other mechanisms at work?
Yeah, so I mentioned the absence of the magnetic field as a way to remove atmospheric particles. But this absence of a magnetic field leads mostly to the removal of charged particles that have some net electrical charge.
Mm-hmm.
There are also ways to lose neutral particles as well. And one of these is called thermal escape, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's particles that escape simply because they have a high temperature. And temperature is a measure of sort of the energy of a group of particles, and temperature more specifically is the average energy of a group of particles. And in any group, you have some above average and some low below average particles. And the above average particles, if they have enough energy, they can escape the planet altogether. As you would expect, this type of escape is more important for light particles than it is for heavy particles. Heavy particles are more attracted to Mars gravitationally, and so we think that thermal escape is really only important for hydrogen at Mars. And so this is another process. A third one that I'll talk about quickly is something called photochemical escape. And this is also for neutral particles. And if you think about the terms there, it also makes sense. Photo means light or from the sun. And so it's sunlight pouring into the Martian atmosphere. And then the chemical part means that that sunlight causes chemical reactions in the Martian atmosphere. These chemical reactions end up breaking molecules apart. For example, oxygen molecules, which consist of two oxygens. When those molecules get broken apart, this chemical reaction gives at least one of them enough energy to escape from the planet. And so in addition to the solar wind stripping, there are these other processes that are driven by sunlight instead of particles from the sun. So the sun is the ultimate cause of all atmospheric escape, we believe, at least in the processes that MAVEN will measure. But sometimes it's sunlight, and sometimes it's the charged particles in the solar wind. So there's this whole suite of things to measure and that are important to measure.
Mm-hmm. But that makes it sound as if the magnetic field is not the only factor in why Mars lost its atmosphere and turned into the kind of cold, forbidding planet that we see today. And I'm guessing that, again, the fact that Mars is smaller than Earth may have had something to do with that. That is it just that these processes would perhaps go on at Earth if it weren't that Earth had sufficient gravity to hold onto its atmosphere?
Yes, it very well could be that these processes would go on at Earth and be important over time. I think that you're right in saying that it's not just the absence of a magnetic field that allows particles to escape, that there are multiple processes that do it. But the absence of a magnetic field influences four out of the six processes that we've identified. So it's a big piece of the escape problem.
Now, Ilse Hesse is asking, with the three satellites that are circling Mars now, and MAVEN might be in addition to that, can we use them for a GPS system for Martian navigation?
Interesting. You know, that's a good question, and one that I don't have a ready answer for. But I would imagine that it's possible to do something like that. And along these lines, there have been people over the years that have considered network missions to Mars, not just sending one probe or one rover, but landing a suite of probes or rovers on the surface or sending them into orbit around Mars. And when this happens, you can easily imagine having the equivalent of a GPS-type network at Mars.
Yeah, you would probably want to have a critical mass of satellite assets in order to do that so that you could triangulate the location of a particular rover on the ground. I know they've talked about that as something to think about for future exploration, is to have so many networked assets available there that you really have the beginnings of a Martian internet almost between all the satellites and the ground-based rovers that are involved in an exploration effort. But maybe it'll take a while to get there.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a lot of science that you can do with such a network mission as well. For example, if you have seismometers on the surface at different places, you can start probing the interior structure of Mars. If you have a combination of rovers and orbiters, you can use the fact that the radio waves that they're transmitting back and forth to each other have to pass through the atmosphere as a way to probe the atmosphere as well. So there's there's interesting science that can fall out of such a network, too.
Now, I wanted to touch on a couple of the fun things in addition to the science, which is fun as well, but it's a little more technical. But I know that the MAVEN team had some opportunities for people to send poems and pictures along with the mission. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, this is great fun. We have an education and public outreach effort associated with MAVEN, with many different projects that have been defined and are being pursued. Some of them have even been completed already. And these are all efforts to share the science of MAVEN with non-scientists to make sure that we're getting the word out about what we're doing. And one of these efforts is the haiku contest and the student art contest. And so we had various classrooms around the country make artwork about Mars and MAVEN after they learned about MAVEN in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And they submitted their artwork, and one classroom, unfortunately, we had to pick one winner, but one classroom was chosen as the winner. And that artwork was used as the art on a DVD that was placed on the MAVEN spacecraft and is sitting there now. But that DVD is not empty. It has information on it, and some of the information that it has are simply the names of people who wanted to submit their name and have their name sent to Mars. But it also has haiku that were submitted in a separate contest, and we received haiku about MAVEN and about Mars from all over the world, and a winning haiku entry was chosen as well and is going to Mars on that DVD.
Mm-hmm. And if folks do a search on haiku and MAVEN, I'm pretty sure they'll quickly catch up with the collection of haiku that were received as a result of this contest. And some of them are really a hoot to read. Some folks had a really good time coming up with haiku that not only reflected the mission, but reflected a great sense of humor as well. So.
Yeah, there was really a range, and it was very entertaining, as you said, to read, because some were very funny and some were very serious and touching and poignant, and there was a good mixture of haikus that had been submitted.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other outreach activities that are up your sleeve, anything that you might want to share about things to look forward to, or are you pretty much focused on the science aspect of the mission right now?
No, I'm happy to talk more about the outreach. I can talk about two things right now that I've been involved in, one of them earlier today, as a matter of fact. Uh-huh. So the one that I was involved in earlier today is called Imagine Mars, and this is an outreach effort that's connecting Native American classrooms with MAVEN science. And rather than describing the broad scope of that project, I'll instead say that we had students from some of these classrooms submit questions about Mars and MAVEN, both in written form and in video form. And then we had MAVEN scientists earlier today videotape their answers to those questions. And we're going to share them back with the students as well. And so that was really fun to talk to students about MAVEN. Another one that I've been involved with has to do with science on a sphere, which you may have heard of before. And this is a projection system that allows you to put data sets onto a globe electronically. And many museums and planetaria around the country are starting to have these spheres as part of their regular display. And so we have made a presentation that can be given at a museum on science on a sphere. And then when the MAVEN data come in and we start being able to paint in the Martian atmosphere with actual observations that MAVEN is making, we'll be able to update this presentation, and it can be in museums and places that have spheres.
Will MAVEN be looking at the surface, or is this going to be kind of a color-coded map that focuses on the atmosphere?
Right. This would be more the latter, a color-coded map that focuses on the atmosphere. And that's because it's the top layers of the atmosphere that serve as the reservoirs for escaping particles. And so this is the part of the swimming pool that's the most important for the UPS. And so that's what MAVEN is designed to measure.
So Albert has a follow-up question about this whole issue of the core and magnetic field. Our core is heated by radioactive decay, so what would shut that down on Mars? Maybe it's a question of just how big it is and how much heat that radioactive decay generates with a smaller core.
That's right. That's exactly right, is that there are three sources of heat for planetary interiors, but two of them are used up very early in solar system history. One of those is the formation of the core itself, and the other one is the formation of the planet initially. But all of that heat is lost, and the heat that we have inside Earth and Mars today all comes from radioactive decay. And Mars' smaller size simply leads to there being less heat inside and not enough heat to sustain the dynamo, even though there's less volume inside Mars in which to sustain the dynamo. There's simply not enough heat from the radioactive decay.
And so this has implications not only for Mars and what happened on Mars, but also, for example, our study of extrasolar planets, of alien planets. So I guess if you want to have your mind blown, you would indulge in speculation about what dynamos on alien planets would have to do with habitability. Have you been thinking about that as well?
Oh, yes, I have, and this is a wonderful question. I spent the first half of my day today writing about that very topic for a funding proposal. And I think that MAVEN is a mission to Mars, and so many people might consider it a Mars mission. But for me, it's really a mission about the atmospheres of planets. And Mars is the closest laboratory that we have to study unmagnetized planets, the planets that are lacking a sneeze guard for the atmosphere. And so the observations that MAVEN can provide, I hope, can be applied to planets that we're discovering around other stars today. We now have about 3,500 planet candidates, most of which will be confirmed as planets. And numbers are being thrown around right now in recent studies that suggest as many as 20% of stars in our galaxies have Earth-like planets as well. So when you form these planets, then you have to start to think about whether they're habitable. And there are lots of elements that you could consider as being required for habitability, and we simply don't know whether magnetic fields are required for habitability. They certainly may play a large role in protecting an atmosphere and keeping it from being stripped away, but we only have a sample size of one right now in our own solar system. We have one habitable planet, and that habitable planet happens to have a magnetic field. And so it may be it may be that magnetic fields play an important role in habitability.
If you were going to try to extend the lessons from MAVEN to other planetary systems, would you simply make assumptions on the basis of the size of a planet, whether it can sustain a magnetic field, that any planets that are about Mars size, you might have to use that as a strike against them when it comes to habitability, whereas perhaps super-Earths get some extra points?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that there are sort of two prongs to this line of thinking. And one would be having some knowledge about the size of the planet or whether it's likely to have a magnetic field, and certainly small planets have a strike against. So Mars-sized planets might not be such a good place to look for life if they're as old as the planets in our solar system are right now. The other prong, though, is to consider whether a magnetic field is required for habitability at all. If we happen to be able to measure whether a planet has a magnetic field, even though it's light years away, if we come up with some way of detecting magnetic fields, then we could use our knowledge of the presence or absence of a magnetic field to perhaps automatically tell us something about what the atmosphere is likely to be like.
I'm going to take a break to get in some announcements, but first I wanted to read a couple of the haiku that came in for the MAVEN DVD, which I particularly liked. And as you remember, haiku, you have 5 syllables in the first line, 7 syllables in the second line, and 5 in the third. And you try to work it so that there's some cleverness about the phrasing. And so one of my favorites is from Craig Houghton of Connecticut, who says, "Maven's engineers write in binary while we count some syllables."
Very nice.
It's a self-referential haiku. And the other one is a personal favorite of mine because of the connection to Marvin the Martian, if anyone remembers that cartoon. It asks, will Maven find the Q36 explosive space modulator?
Oh, nice.
17 syllables. But the top-rated one makes you think. It's from Benedict Smith, and here it is. It's funny. They named Mars after the god of war. Have a look at Earth. I'd say, well done, Benedict. Great thinking there. So the announcements are, I don't know if I actually mentioned who I was. I'm Alan Boyle, science editor at NBCNews.com, and I do a lot of my work in the section called Cosmic Log, but you can find my work in science.nbcnews.com. And we have a lot of help to do these shows. I want to thank our producer, Sherry Reason, and Pulse Avatar for making me look so good in Second Life, and the Exploratorium, San Francisco Museum, that is really hosting us in Second Life at their auditorium and does a lot of great work for science education. And so we're very grateful to everyone. Another person I wanted to thank is James Emley, the rocker scientist who performed the theme song that you heard at the top of the show and you'll probably hear at the end of the show as well. So just as Maven is part of a team effort at Mars, we have a big team here at Virtually Speaking Science, and we do this every week, and so you can look forward to a succession of Virtually Speaking Science shows to come, and you can also find them archived at Blog Talk Radio. And so we've been doing this for quite some time now and really enjoy it. It's a good change of pace for us, and it's a good change of pace for our guests, and we really appreciate having Dave here to talk about the MAVEN mission, NASA's next Mars mission. So let's see, what have we got for questions? We have a couple of off-the-wall questions. We were talking about extrasolar planets, and Smiler Don Carver asks, how much detail about extrasolar planet atmospheres are we able to detect? Well, I don't think MAVEN is going to be involved with that particular question, but I do know that other missions are just getting into the business of detecting extrasolar atmospheres. It's a very difficult problem. It has to do with how you can collect observations of photons that basically come through the atmosphere of an alien planet. But I suppose eventually the results from MAVEN can feed into the models that can tell people how even extrasolar planet atmospheres are constructed. So is that something that you wanted to add anything to, Dave, or should I move on to the next question?
Yeah, no, that's right. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that this was my spot. Yes, there are observations of atmospheres of extrasolar planets. We're starting to get some information about composition, and it's exactly as you said. It's when the planet itself passes in front of its host star or sometimes behind its host star. We can use the different wavelengths, intensities of the different wavelengths of light to tell us what that atmosphere is made from, and in some cases how that atmosphere is changing as well. And there are a couple of interesting examples of atmospheres of planets that we've detected that seem to have atmospheres that are actively escaping today. And these are mostly for Jupiter-sized planets that are very close to their star, and the star is very intense, very hot, and so these stripping processes, both by thermal escape and maybe even solar wind stripping, are leading to essentially almost a comet tail of atmosphere pouring off of these hot Jupiters. And so these are all extremes of the same kinds of processes that MAVEN will measure. And what's nice is having a planet so close where we can make the detailed measurements that we need. And not only that, having measurements of the escaping atmosphere at the same time that we're making measurements of the sun and the solar wind that's driving it. Because it's one thing to make an observation of an escaping atmosphere, and it's another thing to really understand what's under the hood, how it all works. And so I think this is where MAVEN really feeds in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there any significance or any added value in the fact that the sun is reaching its maximum on the 11-year activity level? Is that something that adds to the MAVEN mission, or does it really matter whether it's solar maximum or solar minimum as far as you're concerned?
No, it does matter. I think that this is important. Sorry, I'm having a fun second life experience for the past few minutes here. We will be arriving, we're near solar maximum right now, and so when MAVEN arrives next September and starts making its science observations near the end of next October, we'll be in the declining phase of the solar cycle, that 11-year solar cycle. And one thing that's nice about arriving during that period is that it's during this declining phase that most of the solar storms happen, or that many solar storms happen, and usually the most intense solar storms happen. And solar storms for us are basically a window back in time to what the early solar system may have been like, to what the young sun may have been like, with more frequent storms and more intense storms. And so this is intentional on our part. We would like to make measurements of what happens to the Martian atmosphere during solar storms.
Do you have much contact with other missions, other Mars missions? Is this the sort of thing where you really do get together as a team and see what coordinated observations you can make? I'm wondering if there's really a community of these Mars explorers, you know, using robots to do the exploration, but nevertheless, if it is a team effort, there must be team meetings every once in a while.
Yes, there really is sort of an integrated effort. Maybe on the MAVEN side, there are a couple of formal efforts that we're pursuing via collaborations with other missions, but there's also the informal effort. And so there are scientific conferences, of course, and I think you just returned from one, but there are scientific conferences that are entirely devoted to the atmosphere of Mars. There are scientific conferences that are entirely devoted to Mars, and these happen periodically and are an opportunity for the scientists to get together and swap information. But on the MAVEN level, there are a couple of synergistic observations that we're hoping to make. For example, we have an ion mass spectrometer on board, something that will sniff neutral and ionized particles on MAVEN. And the person who built this ion mass spectrometer is at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, and his name is Paul Mahaffey. And he is also the person that built an atmosphere sniffer on the Curiosity rover. And the two instruments are very similar. And so what's fun for us is that MAVEN will be measuring the atmosphere from the tippy top, the very top layers, and Curiosity is measuring the atmosphere from the bottom. So we're measuring the top and bottom of the swimming pool at the same time, and there's perhaps some opportunity there to figure out how the entire swimming pool works. Another observation on the Curiosity rover is the RAD detector. It's measuring radiation that reaches the surface of Mars. And one reason that you'd like to do that is to prepare for future human exploration and understand the radiation environment on Mars, any radiation that may have sterilized life that developed on the surface of Mars, etc. But solar storms that happen may also impact the Martian atmosphere and increase escape rates. And we'll be measuring some of this particle radiation on MAVEN from the top of the atmosphere at the same time that Curiosity is again measuring it at the bottom. And by combining these measurements, we can learn more about how the atmosphere serves as sort of a screen or a filter for radiation encountering Mars. Mm-hmm. And then one final way in which MAVEN plans to work together with other spacecraft is, in fact, with the European spacecraft Mars Express. This spacecraft is able to measure particles escaping from the atmosphere, but may not have very good measurements about the drivers, how the sun is helping to control those escape rates. And so we've been actively talking together even before MAVEN has ever launched. And there's a group of scientists from both spacecraft that talk every 2 weeks about observations that the two spacecraft could undertake together to better understand how the atmosphere is evolving.
So are there any lessons that could be applied to climate issues on Earth just I would imagine that it's hard to predict that, but on the other hand, I would imagine it's hard to avoid having some lessons from comparative planetary science that you can apply to the home planet.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the fun of planetary science, as far as I'm concerned, is that each planet in our solar system or each planet that we can discover, we're able to compare back to Earth in some way and say, okay, well, Mars is smaller than Earth and it's farther from the Sun, and how do those two differences account for what we see on Mars compared to what we see on Earth? And I think one lesson that we may gain from MAVEN measurements is what will ultimately happen to Earth's atmosphere after its dynamo shuts off. But that should be a long time from now. There's also perhaps something to be learned about what may happen to Earth's atmosphere at time periods that Earth's magnetic field is reversing. Mm-hmm. And this reversal can essentially leave Earth unprotected for centuries at a time as the reversal is taking place. And then a third thing is a comparison of magnetized planets to unmagnetized planets, Mars to Earth. And atmospheric particles do escape from Earth despite its magnetic field, and they usually escape through the poles, the magnetic poles of Earth, in sort of a reverse situation to the processes that cause aurora on Earth. Aurora are caused by particles screaming in along magnetic field lines and crashing into the atmosphere in the poles. And those particles are accelerated towards the planet, and some of those same processes will accelerate atmospheric particles away. And so comparing and contrasting these different processes as they occur on the different planets can help lead us to understand how Earth's atmosphere is evolving as well.
So you mentioned pole reversal, and then that's a big issue for the doomsday crowd. You know, the idea that there's going to be a global catastrophe when the poles reverse. But what is the research about the impact of a pole reversal, and are there any thoughts about what happens to the magnetic field and what sort of situations arise because of that reversal?
Sure. I can first talk a little bit about the magnetic field with the caveat that I'm not an expert in this area,
sure.
But I sort of have a basic understanding of how things work. And then I'll talk a little bit about the atmosphere and consequences
mm-hmm.
there. First of all, magnetic reversals do happen at Earth. We have very solid evidence that this occurs. And that much of that evidence comes from the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean on either side of the spreading center there, where new crust is being created. And on either side of that spreading center, we see magnetized rock, and that magnetized rock alternates in its magnetization direction with a cadence of hundreds of thousands of years. I forget the exact cadence. And we can match either side of this spreading center to tell us that the magnetic field does reverse. How this reversal proceeds is still a bit of a mystery. My understanding is that there are two paradigms that are being considered, two ways that this happens, not so much why it happens, but how it happens. One way is that the magnetic field starts wandering a little bit and wandering towards the equator and then turns over entirely. So it's a continuous process from one pole to the other as the magnetic field flips. But another paradigm sort of suggests that the magnetic field doesn't wander from one pole to the other. Instead, it first shrinks. It reorganizes itself so that it's a much more compact thing.
Mm-hmm.
And after it's shrunk, it flips itself over, and then it grows itself back out again. The second one especially may leave the atmosphere unprotected for a period of time, but the period of time that the atmosphere is unprotected will be very short compared to Earth's age. And if you recall, we're talking about the absence of a magnetic field on Mars removing an Earth's worth of an atmosphere over 4 billion years. And so
mm-hmm.
the stripping processes that we're talking about at Mars are most likely occurring on pretty long timescales, so that I, for one, am relatively unconcerned about a magnetic field reversal and Earth's atmosphere being entirely stripped away. There may be shorter-term implications for protection from radiation if the magnetic field reverses in a certain way. But in terms of atmospheric stripping, I'm not too concerned.
So I imagine some screenwriters for the next disaster movie are just saying, aw, darn, right now. Is this totally fun for you? Tell me what it's like to be working on a Mars mission.
this is amazing. I can't believe, please don't tell my bosses, but I can't believe that I get paid to do this. I can't believe that I get to be a planetary scientist and have hallway conversations about Mars and Venus. And this is the first time in my career that I've been involved with a spacecraft mission from the beginning. Up to this point, I've come in after the spacecraft mission was conceived, even after the spacecraft arrived at its destination. And I've worked on Mars and Venus and the Moon in my career to this point, and a little bit on Jupiter very early on as well. But this is one mission where I got to be involved from almost the very beginning as we were trying to formulate our detailed science goals. We always had the big picture question in mind, but formulate the detailed science goals, match those with measurements, pick instruments, and really put a mission together. And it's just exhilarating to be part of this whole process. And it's a long process. It's older than my children, the MAVEN spacecraft, but it's really gone by very quickly.
Do you expect that your workday routine will change once the mission really gets started, once the spacecraft reaches orbit? I know, for example, with the rovers, people had to shift to a weird time clock and sometimes work in the middle of the night. But I'm guessing that with an orbiter, it's not quite that crucial.
No, it won't be as extreme as for the Curiosity rover where they're living on Mars time. And a Mars day is 24 and a half hours approximately.
Mm-hmm.
But I do expect that my research life will transition a little bit. I mean, everyone involved with the mission has been very busy preparing the instruments, getting the spacecraft ready, getting ready for launch. And that includes even scientists like me who will be end users of the data. We've been preparing our analysis software and visualization tools and things like that. But once the data start coming back, I think my day-to-day life for the MAVEN project will be focused on looking at the most recent results. What has come down in the past couple of days? What is this telling us about Mars? How does it fit into the big picture? And that's a really fun part of planetary science and of spacecraft missions in general, seeing something with your own eyes for the very first time. And that's great.
Dave, B.D. Somerville is asking whether you had any thoughts on the current Indian Mars mission, which was just launched a day or so ago. And they will be studying the atmosphere, too, as I recall. And they'll be perhaps looking at methane also, and maybe you can talk a little bit about the methane question and why MAVEN might not be the best mission for looking at that methane question.
Sure. First, the Indian mission. First of all, I'm very impressed. I was in India last summer for a meeting where they were discussing this mission and planning on putting it together, but their timescale for putting a mission together was very rapid. They put things together very quickly, and so I'm very excited by their launch, and I'm looking forward to seeing the data that they return from their measurements of the Martian atmosphere, and hopefully there are some good synergies there with MAVEN as well. One measurement that they are planning to make, I believe, as you mentioned, is a measurement of methane in the atmosphere. And this is an important trace gas on Earth. Methane can be produced through a few different processes, and some of them are purely geological. But on Earth, as you know, methane can be produced by life as well. And there have been reports over the past several years, maybe almost a decade now, that methane has been detected in the atmosphere of Mars. And this is exciting for two reasons. Number one, when you model the atmosphere of Mars and the chemical reactions that should take place in that atmosphere, methane doesn't survive very long. It doesn't survive for more than 300 years or so in the Martian atmosphere, and this is the blink of an eye in solar system history. So if we really are detecting methane in the Martian atmosphere, whatever its origin, it got there recently. It's either being vented from the interior in some way or produced in reactions at the surface, or there's life on Mars that's producing that methane. So this is what has people so excited. And there's been a controversy in the Mars community in the past couple of years trying to decide whether these detections of methane, reports of detected methane in the Martian atmosphere, are valid, not valid, but really tell us that methane is in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And there have been some suggestions that that maybe methane hasn't been detected in the atmosphere at all. So the Curiosity rover is making some measurements and so far has not detected methane on the surface, but it hasn't been making measurements for that long and it may be in the wrong place on Mars entirely. And the Indian mission, which is an orbiter, will hopefully also make measurements of methane in the atmosphere. And an upcoming European mission, Trace Gas Orbiter, will also be looking for methane. So this is a big question for Mars scientists. Early on in our planning process for MAVEN, after we had been selected, we had a discussion among the team about whether to modify some of our measurements so that we could look for methane in the Martian atmosphere. And this is an enticing question and one that I think we all would have been happy to explore. But in the end, we decided that we had been selected to fly based on the science that we proposed, the science of the escaping atmosphere, and that to change our measurements or add measurements jeopardized our ability to meet our schedule, to launch on time, perhaps, and to come in under budget, both of these incredibly important for NASA missions. And so the decision was not to add a methane measurement to MAVEN. And in the end, here we are looking at launch in a week and a half, and we are on schedule and we are under budget. So at least we were still able to meet our schedule and budget.
I guess we've discussed this question before, and it's a question that I think a lot of scientists, whether they're planetary scientists or theoreticians, come across is, why does it matter? What do we gain by knowing what happened to the Martian atmosphere? And I'm sure you deal with that question quite a bit. What do you tell people when they ask you about that?
Yeah, I've dealt with this question not only with other people. I enjoy dealing with it with other people, but I've also dealt with it personally, I think, as I've sort of planned the trajectory of my career to the extent that one can plan such a thing. But if I'm working on planetary science, I want to be working on a question that I think would be important to anyone. Whether or not they're a planetary scientist. And I do believe that these questions are important to anyone. And it all, for me, goes not only back to atmospheres and how atmospheres on planets work, but the role that atmospheres play in whether a planet can be habitable. And right now we know of one place that is habitable in the entire universe, and that's here on Earth. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we could learn whether there is another habitable place out there? And understanding how climates evolve, whether Mars was habitable long ago, I think is moving in this direction of habitability. It's fundamentally important to understand how and where life can develop in the solar system. And any progress you can make towards answering that question, I think, is worth making. It's worth doing it.
So we're less than 2 weeks away from the launch now, and maybe you can let folks know how to keep tabs on the preparations, what to watch for in the next couple of weeks, and when you're going to be able to relax. What can we look forward to, and where should we look for that?
Sure. There are a few fingers crossed moments in the life of a spacecraft mission, as I understand it, and the first one is being selected to fly, and we're past that and over that hurdle, so that's great. And we've passed all of our reviews to this point and are ready to fly. So the next big milestone is launch, and our launch window opens November 18th, and the launch window stays open approximately 3 weeks, and this is because Earth and Mars are moving relative to each other, and we only have a certain amount of fuel on our spacecraft. So if we don't make this launch window, then we'll have to wait 26 months for the next launch window to open. And right now we are prepared to meet the very first day of our launch window on November 18th, so that's a big milestone. We have a 10-month cruise to Mars, and during that cruise, a few of the instruments will be stretching their legs a little bit and making observations. And there will also be some observations, as I understand it, made by MAVEN, of Comet Ison, a comet that will be passing through the inner solar system. And MAVEN's UV instrument especially will be making a few observations of the atmosphere of that comet. will arrive at Mars in September of 2014. And if we go on the first day, if we launch on the first day, we'll arrive September 22nd of 2014. And this is another big fingers crossed moment in the life of a spacecraft mission. And this is orbit insertion, where we'll fire our thrusters and instead of sailing right by Mars, we'll go into orbit around Mars. Once we're in orbit around Mars, we'll orbit in a commissioning phase. So we'll have our normal orbit, but the instruments will be opened up and start taking a few measurements, and we'll be calibrating some things, and that will happen for about a month. And near the end of October 2014, or November 1st, 2014, somewhere around then, we'll start taking our science observations. And we'll take one Earth year of science observations, and then we'll see what happens after that. Regardless, MAVEN will continue to orbit Mars. The laws of physics don't stop after one Earth year. And MAVEN can still serve as a relay for assets on the Martian surface.
Great. Well, this hour has just flown by, and I really want to voice my appreciation to you. We've been talking with Dave Brain, a co-investigator for NASA's MAVEN mission. Dave is a planetary researcher at the University of Colorado. And I also want to give a shout-out to the Exploratorium for hosting us, to Pulse Avatar for our look in Second Life. Sometimes I say that I look better in Second Life than I do in First Life. So there you go. And our producer at Virtually Speaking, Sherry Reason, it's, like I've said before, it's a great team that brings you these shows, and it's a great team that is bringing NASA's next mission to Mars. So thanks so much for being with us, Dave, and I hope to hear some great updates from the mission as the launch and the crews and the scientific mission proceeds.
Thanks again for having me. This was great fun.
Okay, very good. So for Virtually Speaking Science, I'm Alan Boyle, science editor at NBCNews.com, wishing you a good evening. Tune us in, and in the meantime, watch the skies.